So now let's get to the whole weather story once again, because it's totally a coincidence that we are talking about a historically huge storm in our region's history on the very day that we are talking about the aftermath of Tropical Storm Michael. 56 years ago on this very date, the weather began turning ugly in our region. When 3 days of truly awful and remarkable weather ended, several people were dead and damage across the landscape ran into the millions of dollars. In Oregon, the event is called the Columbus Day Storm of 1962. It is well documented and even well remembered by people in the region, and it gets a new comprehensive treatment in a new book. John Dodge is the author of A Deadly Wind, the 1962 Columbus Day Storm. John actually remembers the Columbus Day Storm, having lived through it as a teenager. He worked as a journalist for years covering other disasters, including the Mount St. Helens major eruption. John retired from the Olympian newspaper in Washington in 2015. John Dodge, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you wrote about the storm on several of its anniversaries. Did you seem to learn new things about the storm and the people affected each time?
Yes, I did. Stories just kept cropping up any time we gave a treatment to the storm. And there's just countless stories out there from storm survivors.
So I understand a phone call as the 50th anniversary approached kindled this book. Who was on the other end of that phone call?
We knew we were going to do a story for the 50-year anniversary, but I wasn't sure what. And then just almost like magic, I receive a call from a gentleman named Bill Bruder, who lives in Shelton, Washington, not too far from Olympia. And he was a retired Navy weather observer who had been stationed in Guam in 1962 with a kind of a dual purpose of tracking typhoons over the skies of the Pacific Ocean and looking out for Russian submarines. Recall, we were in the midst of a Cold War
right.
In 62. In fact, 10 days after the storm, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, right, sure. Wow, that's amazing.
So he had this very interesting story of tracking Typhoon Frida across the ocean and for 4 or 5 days island hopping across the ocean. And it turned out that he was of the firm belief that this storm had enough power to make landfall on the West Coast in some destructive form. But his superiors in Pearl Harbor told the crew to turn the plane around and come back to Guam. Don't worry, these storms always dissipate. Well, we know that wasn't the case this time.
So, wow. So he really had a feeling it was going to happen the way it did happen, and yet he was told not
and
to worry about it.
He had felt like a voice in the wilderness. He had tried to get people to pay attention to him over the years, and I think I was the first one to give him any attention.
So you mentioned us the Typhoon Frida, by the time it reached us, was a non-tropical storm, and what's the difference there?
Correct. So Typhoon Frida, actually, by the time it reached the stomping grounds off the coast of Northern California, was a non-tropic, had morphed into what we would call a mid-latitude or non-tropical cyclone. It provided a lot of the fuel for the storm, but it wasn't a typhoon per se anymore.
So was there much rain to speak of with all the wind?
You know, that's a good question. The days preceding the storm had been quite rainy. Eugene had several inches of rain. But the day of the storm, as the winds progressed south to north, it was primarily a balmy day with very little rain, but a lot of wind. Now, to the south, in the Bay Area, and much of your listenership was being inundated with rain that lasted for 3 or 4 days. Some areas up around Shasta and north of Redding were receiving over 20 inches of rain in a 3 or 4 day period.
Wow, that's like a year's worth of rain plus.
Yeah,
for some of the communities.
There was massive flooding in the Oakland Hills. People were buried in mudslides, and this was all happening. Meanwhile, the winds had moved on, but the rain just kind of stalled out over Northern California and Southern Oregon.
So just as we're talking about hurricane now, Tropical Storm Michael in Florida's panhandle and working up the southeast as a historical storm, how big was the Columbus Day storm in historical context in its time?
Well, at the time that I started doing the research in 2012, I found numerous meteorologists that would call it the largest non-tropical windstorm in the lower 48. Well, lo and behold, a couple weeks after the anniversary, we had Superstorm Sandy make landfall on the East Coast, and it took over kind of the top perch. However, the Columbus Day storm winds were stronger. We didn't have a storm surge, though, which caused most of the devastation from Superstorm Sandy. But the two storms were very close in composition.
All right, so that's a good comparison then. So it was close to Superstorm Sandy in intensity, not with the water, perhaps, but certainly with
right.
the winds, yeah.
And Superstorm Sandy was a hurricane when it was out over ocean water moving toward the East Coast. But when it made landfall, the National Weather Service reclassified it as an extratropical storm.
So of all the surprises about the storm, though, I'm more surprised about the coverage of it. You discovered nobody had written a single full-length book dedicated to the storm until you started yours?
Yeah, that was true, and that gave me a little impetus. There were, I want to give credit where credit is due. There are two very useful and informative, I'll call them booklets or almost like a scrapbook in one case, one by Ellis Lucia, a Portland author and journalist who wrote about a 65-page booklet with a lot of photos called, in 1963, he did this story, this booklet, and it was a big smash. I think he sold over 50,000 copies, which is a pretty remarkable number considering the time and the population. And then a nurse in Salem, Dorothy Franklin, put together more of a scrapbook-type account with lots and lots of pictures, and she called hers West Coast Disaster. Now, both of these publications are still available. You'll find them in libraries. You don't find them in bookstores. But
okay, John, hang on a second. Yep. We have to take a break. Deadly Wind is John Dodge's book. We'll come back and talk more about that and the storm in a minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John Dodge, a longtime newspaper reporter and writer. He has compiled his own book, a full-length book about one of the most destructive events in Oregon history. It's called The Deadly Wind, the 1962 Columbus Day Storm. The winds blew probably 170 miles an hour anyway, and in some cases just broke the measuring devices that record the wind speed. And you can join the conversation on the exchange. Maybe you have some memories of your own to share with us. We have at least one person online waiting to tell his story. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And John, you were talking about two earlier published accounts of the Columbus Day storm, both still available, you say?
Yeah, you can find them in libraries. And I don't want to make any false claims here about being the only person to ever write about the storm, but I think you're characterizing it accurately, the first full-length treatment.
So once you began to seek out storm survivors, did that unleash something of a torrent?
Well, it was an interesting process. I did find a number of very interesting survivors and their stories through happenstance. For instance, I was serving on the editorial board at the Olympian in about, I think, 2014, and we had community members on the board, and one of our community members was the sister of a fellow in Eugene who was in an apartment complex that was struck by a roof flying off of a nearby high school or junior high school. Anyway, he was in a bedroom with a friend of his who was pierced in the chest with a piece of wood and ended up dying later that night. And he had an unbelievable account and memory of what it was like that night. And I would have never found him if my partner on the editorial board hadn't told me about him.
Now, the guy whose friend died was injured himself, but had medical training, right?
Yeah, he was. He gave first aid just before he passed out from loss of blood.
Wow. Let's start taking some accounts from listeners here. Let's go to Steve and Eugene. Yep. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the Columbus Day storm with John Dodge. Hi, Steve.
At South Eugene High School and in a play, Stalag 17.
Uh-huh.
And our director, Ed Ragazzino, had the bright idea, since we were an all-male cast, to go up to McKinsey for a weekend of intensive rehearsal. And he just happened to choose October 12th as the day we'd be up there. On our way out of town, we had a big old limb from a maple crashed down on our cars, kind of an omen. And fortunately, it was leafy enough and had enough small branches on it that we could pull out from under it and continue because the show must go on. Got up there. I had a small part in this play, so I could stand on the back deck and hear pop. Pop, pop, pop. Other branches or whole trees being blown over down the McKinsey Valley. It was kind of fun, I thought.
Wow. But anybody hurt in your crowd? And did you end up getting home okay?
No, we were all fine.
All right, Steve, thanks for sharing the story. I want to move on here with John, but a lot of stories like that, it sounds like, John, with people who heard things they'd never heard before, saw things they never saw before.
Indeed, part of the reason that it was such a seminal moment for people was the sheer suddenness of it all and the violence. We had very little advance warning of what was happening.
Which gets us into the forecast part of this, and which you deal with right in the head of Chapter 1. What did the forecast predict for that Friday, October 12th, 1962?
Well, the forecast out of San Francisco, bear in mind that Thursday had been a very stormy day in Northern California and Southern Oregon. Gold Beach was hit very hard by hurricane-force winds. So it's interesting to note the storm of October 12th was preceded by a pretty good-sized fatal storm on the 11th. So anyway, the forecast for the 12th was that we would probably see gale force winds on the coast, but you know, nothing out of the ordinary for this time of the year. They did not see this coming on Thursday night. They didn't really know what was happening until some ships at sea, Liberty ship fleet, off the coast began radioing in some pretty serious wind speeds and barometric pressure drops that warned them that maybe Friday's going to be a little more serious than we thought, which led to a wind warning out of Portland in the morning hours that was never updated as the day went on.
So, but now one forecaster you describe in the book, Jack Capel at KGW-TV and radio, went out on a limb. And it was a little nervous about it at times, about saying, no, he thought this was going to be a storm of great destruction. What did he see that got him to react differently from the National Weather Service?
What Jack was at the weather station in Portland at the Portland airport, and he did that every day. He would go out there and talk to his fellow meteorologists and work up a weather forecast for his radio and TV broadcast at night. So anyway, he's out there trying to figure out what's going on. He sees the dramatic barometric pressure drops that these ships are reporting, and then he notices that all up and from the south moving north, entire communities were kind of blanking out. The weather stations in Salem and Eugene went off the grid. And so he kind of pieced together that something very devastating was moving up the Willamette Valley, and he predicted at about 5:15 that Portland was about to see a wind like no other. And lo and behold, about 5:30, all hell broke loose in Portland.
And he was actually driving from the airport to the TV studio downtown. And what were some of the things he saw along the way?
Well, he saw signs and flying through the air, and he saw a Willamette River that looked more like, you know, an ocean with swells and waves of unusual size. He saw bridges swaying. I think the St. John's Bridge had a vertical sway of up to 15 feet. So 5 out of the 9 bridges over the Willamette were closed, and he had to kind of muscle his way across a bridge just to get back to downtown. And of course, everybody in the newsroom is waiting for Jack to tell him what the heck is going on. And then KGW lost their transmission tower as it blew away in a 85 to 90 mile an hour gust. And then they had to go on emergency generators to stay on the air.
So what is the highest recorded speed from that storm? Do we know?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think you had just mentioned 170 miles an hour. That is an estimated speed at Cape Blanco at the Coast Guard station. What was happening on the headlands of southern Oregon was probably the most severe exposure and wind velocity. We have winds of over 100 miles an hour in at least 8 to 10 locations, and the 170 may be the high. Some people have thought it was even higher at Cape Blanco, but in many cases, the wind gauges measuring velocity were blowing away at the peak of the storm, so we may never have seen some of the peak gusts recorded.
Wow, what an amazing story, an amazing storm spawned by Typhoon Frida out in the Pacific. We're talking with John Dodge about his book about the Columbus Day storm in 1962 called A Deadly Wind. You can join us on The Exchange. Share some stories if you have some about that time in history or another storm you may have seen. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John in Veneta. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, this is one of the big things in my life. I lived in Florence at the time. I was a kid, about 12, 13, and I remember it just like it was yesterday. I swear to you, I do. It is just burned into my head. It was unbelievable. The story I heard was the Coast Guard called the schools like a couple hours before they finally let us out. And nobody was taking it that serious. So I can remember the first gust was when we were lining up for the buses, and then it was going across the bridge there at Florence, and look out across the dunes on the south side of the bank of the river there. And it wasn't near the foliage out under the dunes as there is now. And you have those snags, they're killed by the sand coming around and girdling these trees. And I looked out there, and when those first really heavy gusts hit, it was pulling things out of the sand, and they were flying horizontal like 100 foot, 200 foot above the dune, like a big spear. I can't even hardly believe it now, but I seen it. And then on top of that, one of the big gusts hit, it shoved the bus. And this was one of the big diesels like that you see now, a school bus, into the other lane. Luckily, there was no car coming. I remember looking up in the mirror and seeing the bus driver's face, and he was sweating. And I tell you, from there, for another few hours, it was only about 7 hours in my memory, and I don't remember rain, really. It was just incredible. And this was a kid that lived in Florence, and believe me, it's not foreign to powerful down there, but this was in something class by itself.
All right, John, thanks for sharing the story with us. And again, John Dodge, you've been hearing a lot of stories like this, I'm sure, in your research.
Mm-hmm. It's like he said, the storm is seared into his memory, into his brain, and I think we're all the storm survivors have a kind of a common bond. Now, we did have roughly 60 plus fatalities in the storm and over 300 serious injuries, but just the sheer number of survivors that have a story like that, and we'll never forget it.
So now to the genesis. You say that the typhoons deliver a semblance of order to the Earth's complicated weather system. I mean, so big storms are essentially corrective measures?
Well, that's one way of saying it. The global wind patterns are distributing the weather, and if we didn't have these weather movements, these wind storms, the tropics, the areas around the equator would probably be uninhabitable. They'd be so hot, and we need these winds to move around, circulate the air and move it around. But anyway.
Wow. So that, all right. So it's a way. It is a way of things moving from one place to the other. Air masses.
Always got the, you know, in a high pressure, low pressure kind of yin and yang situation. The high pressure is always rushing to fill the void of the low pressure areas, and it's kind of a key ingredient in wind.
All right, so that is a big question here, because you mentioned the barometric pressure and how low it got many times in the course of the book. So essentially what's going on is when there is a low that big, there will naturally be great winds as air rushes in to fill that low?
Yeah, I think that's a good, safe, simple explanation. It's the pressure gradient differences and the temperature, air temperature differences that fuel these extratropical storms, which is different than what happens with the hurricanes and typhoons. They're fueled by warm water.
Now, I love the story that you include in here about an Oregon school bus driver who was actually tracking the barometric pressure and noticed the drop. What did he do?
Well, Al Spady was a logger who probably took on the school bus driving duties as a second job, but he was home having lunch, and it was probably about 1:30 or so, and he had a barometer in his home, and he saw it, the needle dropped to places he'd never seen before, and he just used his instincts to propel him to go to school right away and rush into the principal's office and tell him there's something big about to happen. We got to get these kids out of school and get them home safely. So he convinced the school officials to let school out. This was in Waldport. And he had his kids on his bus and delivering them home just right in front of the storm.
Wow. You mentioned, as we're talking about the Oregon coast here, about the damage in Gold Beach. And 33 years I've been looking at that picture of the collapsed tower at Western Oregon University. You're the first person I can remember describing effects on Gold Beach. And they were quite significant, weren't they?
They were. Gold Beach was really hammered on Thursday. And they also had a school assembly scheduled for 9 o'clock on Friday morning. And the second storm struck around 7 in the morning in Gold Beach. And if they had been assembled in the gymnasium, we probably would have had significant injuries, if not fatalities.
Wow.
And trailer homes were flying through the air. I don't think we had any fatalities in Gold Beach, but again, it just seems almost like a miracle.
It does. Now, the most of the fatalities, I understand, were in the Willamette Valley. Eugene, it sounds like, got the hardest hit from the Friday winds.
Yeah, the Friday storm, the main storm, we can account for 5 fatalities in Eugene, which is one more than Portland, and, you know, just a fraction of the population of Portland. I think some of it's just sheer quirks of fate, but heart attacks and the fellow I mentioned with the pierced chest from the wood flying through the air. In another case, a wall at a rest home crumbled and toppled into a resident's room and crushed her.
And then there's a description of
didn't have the highest winds, but it had the most fatalities.
Well, and not surprising, given all the things that could and did fall down. You describe University of Oregon students standing on campus watching in horror. What was going on there?
I think they, just like almost everybody else on the path of the storm, didn't know what was going on and were drawn, fascinated to the swaying trees and toppling trees, and then all of a sudden they go, oh my goodness, we better find shelter. The trees were falling all around them, and you know, University of Oregon campus is so heavily wooded, it was a dangerous place to be outside.
And there's a picture in the book. There are quite a few pictures in the book, I should point out. And one of them is of Dee Dee Hall, which, of course, has been in the news in the last couple of years for who it was named for, but just surrounded by downed trees. And the hall looks fine, but everything around it looks like a real scene of devastation.
Yeah. I did a trip to Eugene for some of my book research, and I walked the campus and looked around and then compared kind of today to what I saw in photos in 62. And indeed, there's a number of places where you can tell the trees are only, you know, 50 years old, and they're replacement trees from ones that were fallen in the wind.
Yeah, and the ones that fell were very big indeed. We're talking about the 1962 Columbus Day storm with John Dodge, the author of the book A Deadly Wind. We'll come back and talk more with John and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to share your own experiences, if you have them, from the storm, or just to ask some questions about what happened there. It was a unique situation. We'll come back and talk more with John Dodge about A Deadly Wind and talk to you as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. 56 years ago today, the weather began turning ugly in our region. 3 days of rain to the south generally, and then wind to the north, produced some of the greatest destruction the region has ever seen. It is encapsulated in John Dodge's new full-length book called A Deadly Wind, the 1962 Columbus Day Storm. You can join the conversation on the exchange and may even have some memories to share about that period in history. In October of 1962, 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back and talk about Bill Bruder, who was one of the few people who really thought this storm was going to be something. He was in a plane tracking the storm in the Pacific, and he apparently had some scary moments out there. What happened, John?
Well, there was actually, I think, the scariest thing that Bill talks about was a separate mission when the crew flew the plane into the eye of the storm. Eye of a storm, a different typhoon, and then it sounded pretty harrowing when you try to fling yourself out of the eye of the storm, pretty turbulent. But he did have one very memorable experience where he was plotting his information on a table in the plane on a chart, and they hit a air pocket, some sort of sudden pressure changed, and it shot him up out of his seat and banged his head on the roof of the plane, and then he, you know, threw him back down. So they were getting bounced around pretty good up in the air. They were behind the storm, but I think they were also flying into some very turbulent weather.
Yeah, he was not permanently injured, which makes the story a little funnier because of the fact that everybody else was buckled in.
He was buckled in afterwards. I remember he said that woke him up, and he decided he better fasten his seatbelt.
Yeah, I'm going to sit down now. Yeah, you talked to some people as well who were on ships at sea, and what did they experience?
Boy, some of those stories were fascinating. We had this fleet of old refurbished World War II Liberty ships that were assigned the task of basically patrolling the West Coast and East Coast, about a dozen ships on each side of the country. And again, this is a Cold War military strategy to keep an eye out for Russian submarines. But they served a valuable purpose for providing weather data to the Weather Bureau on both coasts. So anyway, when this storm struck, they were the first to really report it and experience it. And they, I had people tell me about feeling like maybe their ship was going to break in two, or they weren't sure if they were going to survive. They saw waves that like they'd never seen before. I would imagine it wasn't unusual for the waves to be over 50 feet high. One of the fellows on one of the ships was talking about how they couldn't make headway into the wind. It was literally blowing them to a standstill.
Wow, so just you know, trying to motor ahead into the storm, and they weren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. But you report in the book that there were even big waves from the wind on Shasta Lake. That is very far inland.
Yeah, there was, 6-foot waves on Shasta Lake. And again, I'm not sure why that far inland they were seeing that sort of effect, but Redding and Red Bluff and Shasta and Eureka, you know, Northern California was seeing hurricane force winds.
Wow. And so there's another weather forecaster who comes into the book, Jim Holcomb. You talk about him, and he hadn't seen anything like this in his career either, it sounds like.
No. He was on duty Friday morning in the Portland station, and he was the fellow that saw the ticker tape coming in from the ships at sea with this severe barometer drop, pressure drop, over a short period of time. They call it a meteorological bomb. And he was almost fearful to report it to his superiors, thinking that it may be a false reading from the ship. But he told his superiors what he was seeing, and they did decide to go ahead to issue a wind warning. But they would not ever suggest that a record wind was about to occur. That was kind of a policy of the Weather Bureau at the time, and maybe even today, not to ever forecast a record, predict a record wind. So they kept the forecast down around 50 to 60 mile an hour winds, when it turns out Portland saw 100 mile an hour winds.
Wow, that is a lot of wind. Mount Hebo on the Oregon coast got some wind figures that are almost beyond comprehension.
Yeah, Mount Hebo is an interesting place. You drive up there, and you realize how exposed it is to the south, and you're up over 3,000 feet. It's one of the highest places on the Coast Range, and it's an inhospitable place to be, and it was a tough duty to be assigned to that Air Force station. You were issued winter clothing in the summertime, and they saw severe winds and snow and rain all the time, but they never saw anything like this before. Again, this is another place where the recorded wind was probably shy of the actual peak winds that occurred, but they were up in the what'd we see up there in Hebo, 131 miles an hour officially, and estimates that it was probably more like 160.
All right, let's take another call here. We have Don and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Dodge, the author of A Deadly Wind, the 1962 Columbus Day Storm.
Well, John, I'll have to get your book, and I guess we missed some great surfing. But I arrived here in 1965 and actually lived in the married student housing.
Oh, yeah.
That was hit by the roof of Roosevelt. And I guess the architect didn't supervise the construction of the gym. The nailing was incorrect. They found there was a big lawsuit about that. The other thing is that the Register Guard, I did a little research on this storm, and the Register Guard was an evening newspaper. And at the time, if you check the records on the front page, there's a little blurb that says, "Weather to improve tomorrow." That was the night before.
Oh, boy.
So, and, you know, before satellites and radar and the measurements that we have today, the surveillance, boy, they really got it wrong.
Yeah.
They did. Don, thanks for that. Appreciate it. So you do get into that in the book, though. I mean, John, the stuff that we sort of take for granted that is available to forecasters today was not available back then.
Absolutely. The Pacific Ocean, which covers over roughly a third of the Earth's surface, is a big, big stomping grounds for storms that were just moving around out there without any detection. We had no satellites. Actually, the first weather satellite was launched in 61, and it was still kind of hit and miss on the images it was relaying back to Earth. We really have come a long ways in weather forecasting since 62. As you well know, we get these warnings on a major storm 3 to 5 days in advance now instead of hours.
Well, and then some of the effects, as we mentioned, partly because the forecast had underplayed things, but also because people were experiencing things they hadn't experienced before, like the sudden rise in temperatures that so many people noted. What was going on there?
Well, there was the high-pressure system in front of the storm, I guess, was significant enough to cause these spikes in temperature. I think in many places the temperature was in the mid-50s that day, but as the storm advanced, it warmed up to over, 60, 65 degrees for a brief period of time.
Well, let's take another call here. We have, John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Dodge, the author of A Deadly Wind.
Thanks. Oh, I was in the storm. I was in Portland. Our family lived there, and it was about 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And I remember Mom said, come on outside and look at all this stuff flying around. We went in, and of course, the power went out immediately, and it blew over the chimney. That was crazy. The big chimney, two old-fashioned stones and stuff. And yeah, you're right. No warning, nothing. No radar in those days. Just where'd that come from? And we hid in the basement, we had a basement in those days. And gosh, I'll never forget that. So it's good. Got to find your book. What's the name of it again?
It's called A Deadly Wind.
Perfect. Okay.
And it's on Oregon State University Press. Thanks for that, John. John Dodge, I have failed to ask you thus far where you rode out the storm because you were in the region too.
Yeah, I was a 14-year-old, and I was attending a high school football game near Olympia that was canceled right before kickoff by the state patrol. A trooper came on the field with a megaphone and told us all that we needed to head for safety. There was a major storm coming, so this is about 7 o'clock. My family opted to take refuge over at a friend's home in a small housing development, thinking that it would be safer than to go home to our rural home in the woods, and for fear of falling trees. So
sure.
We go to a neighbor's friend's home, and then huddled around in the family room as the fence blew apart and flew away, and then a 60-year-old Douglas fir tree crashed into the garage and patio and onto the roof of the house that we were sitting in. And so my folks, that was interesting, because when we got home late that night to survey damage at home, our house was unscathed. So we may have picked the wrong place to ride out the storm.
Wow. So the place in the country was fine.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
A lot of trees down, though.
A lot of trees down, sure. Let's take another call here. Rika in Grants Pass, welcome to the Exchange.
Well, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, my dad worked at Mount Hebos several years after the storm. We were there in Tillamook for 5 years, and he was a senior master sergeant, and he was being called up on that mountain frequently in the winter to fix things when the radar bubbles would roll off the their buildings, roll down the mountain.
Oh, yeah. The destruction of that radar bubble was one of the more interesting pictures in the book, John Dodge.
Yeah, those hexagonal squares, I think, weigh anywhere from 50 to 100 pounds. And it's kind of like a puzzle the way they were putting that radome shield together. They tackled the construction project probably a little late in the year, but they thought they'd have enough time to finish it. Well, they were only a little over halfway complete when the storm struck, and pieces of the shield were flying around in the air like frisbees and slicing into trees, and I just can't imagine what it was like to be up there in the barracks.
No, neither can I. And I'm just, you know, just hearing stories from yesterday from people who were out covering what was then Hurricane Michael and watching signs break loose and go right past the area where they'd been standing just a few moments before. I mean, these are the kinds of things that happen in huge wind events. And is this how a lot of people got injured and how the fatalities occurred?
It is. Flying debris was a source of fatalities. Falling trees, probably the number one source of fatalities, either people in their cars in transit or in their yards, in their homes.
John,
that
just
was the force multiplier of the storm.
Sure.
Was the falling timber.
Just a minute left here, John Dodge. Of all the people you talked to, is there one story of this storm that sticks with you more than any other?
I would have to go back to the young fellow in Spanaway, Washington, near Tacoma, who was out in his yard playing around in the wind like little kids would do, and he was mauled by a lion. His neighbors had a fenced enclosure and owned two lioness twin. They were more than cubs. They weren't full grown, but they were, you know, we'll call them kind of teenage lions. Anyway, he was mauled by one of these lions that had broke free from the enclosure, and has an unbelievable story to tell about how he survived that and how his parents rescued him and got him to the hospital and got him stitched up. And he'll never forget it, that's for sure.
No, and it sounds like nobody who experienced that storm ever will either. The book is called A Deadly Wind, the 1962 Columbus Day Storm. It's the work of John Dodge, who has been a journalist for many years, retired from the Olympian 3 years ago. John, thanks for the work, and thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
It was my pleasure.
All right, take care.